This is John Rivette with Gladys Beckwith on October 9th, 2008. Mostly going to chat about MSU and faculty unionization attempts, because otherwise this interview will go on for a year. So we'll.
That's true. That's true.
But I'm more than willing
to
come
to
back
sit
another
down here. Okay.
Another time to continue. But. Maybe it would be helpful if you'd be willing to say when you, your name, when you were born, where you were born.
That's fine, no problem.
When you came to Michigan or Michigan State.
Well, I'm a Michigan product. My name is Gladys Beckwith. I was born in 1929, the year of the Great Crash, although we may be heading for an even greater one, one cannot say. I was born in Flint, Michigan.
Flint?
Yeah, Flint, Michigan. Went to Flint Central High School, and then went to for 2 years to Flint Junior College, or as it was then, and now it's Mott Community College.
Okay.
And went on to MSU. And got my BA, my MA, and my PhD from MSU, although I did take some courses from the U of M.
Oh.
Yeah, that's all about me.
What year did you graduate with your BA or your PhD from MSU?
1947. I graduated from Flint Central 1947, 1949 from Flint Junior College 1951. I got my BA from MSU.
Okay.
Yeah, and I got my PhD in 1967.
And just briefly, what you do between those 16
well,
years,
I worked,
you did some other things.
I taught. I'm married for one thing. I married a man from Flint, actually, whom I met at Flint Junior College. And then he came on to MSU, and we married and lived over in the student housing.
Which part of the student
housing? Well, it was way before your time, John. We lived in the trailers one summer. Do you know about the trailers?
A little bit.
Yeah, that's where the state police barracks are.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then we moved over to Spartan Village into the barracks, where they moved that barracks housing from.
Okay.
And where they moved it from.
Well, I don't know if you know, after we lived on the west side near you, we moved to East Lansing, and we moved to Lantern Hill neighborhood.
Yeah, I know where that is.
Okay. And the Lantern Hill neighborhood was 41 faculty families who had lived in MSU housing
in the late 40s.
And they bought half a farm and created this Lantern Hill Association.
Yeah.
Miles Boylan was the kind of the head of the group, but it included all kinds of faculty, including
Pauline and Walter Adams,
including the Adams, and Killingsworth, who was the LAR chair. Anyway, so I didn't know that you were one of those faculty families at that point.
Well, see, we were a little later, early 50s, 1951. We weren't part of the group that was under Neil's clearly.
But you lived in the trailers and then Spartan Village apartments.
You sure? It was fun.
Then did you move to the west side of Lansing?
Oh, no. It was fun, too. You know, that was when the veterans came back.
Uh-huh.
It set a whole different tone that probably never existed again, but there were many veterans in those married housing units. No.
Where were you teaching?
That was just after we got my BA, both of us, and then Jerry went on to get his master's degree, and I began teaching. I taught for half a year over in Ionia in the public schools, and then I taught in Sunfield. Do you know where Sunfield is?
Sure.
Yeah, I taught fifth and sixth grade there.
Oh.
Yeah, and then both of us taught down in Brighton for a year. And then Jerry got a job at Ohio University down in Athens, Ohio. And I got a public school teaching job there in a little town called Marshfield that was really Appalachia. I guess we're supposed to call it Appalachia now, but it was Appalachia then. And that was a real learning experience for me, because that was before any of the poverty programs. You know, they were just talking. I had never seen desperate poverty like that before. For some of my students, the meal that they got at lunch from the federal program was probably the only meal they had that day.
This on the east, the southeast side of Ohio, over by West Virginia?
Yes, just across the river from West Virginia, Athens, Ohio.
Okay. Is that near Huntington?
Well, in West Virginia, it's not far from Huntington.
Yeah.
There were still some mines working, but not many strip mines. And that was about the only source of employment for people there.
Wow.
But it was a great experience, but we just stayed there a year, and then Jerry got a job as assistant director of broadcasting at the University of Maine up in Orono.
I didn't know you lived in Maine for a while.
Oh, we did. I love Maine.
It's very pretty.
It's beautiful. The main people are wonderful people, very sensible, down-to-earth people. We were there 4 years, and I taught again in junior high in the town of Old Town, which, or know what Old Town was, sister city, sister towns, I guess you could say. And then Jerry got a very prestigious grant from the Ford Foundation, Leadership in the Mass Media. There were only 12 of those given that year in the country, none in Maine, and only one in New England. And that subsidized a year of study, which we came back to MSU, because they had a developing program in communication arts there. And I got a grad assistantship there.
What department?
It was preparatory English at that time. It must have been in the College of Arts and Letters, I think, And
was all that teaching in junior high and high school and elementary language arts or English-related subjects?
It was English-related, all of it,
Okay.
And so,
your BA must have been in something related to English? Or
it was English.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and my MA too. My PhD was in education with a minor in English.
Oh, okay. So that brings you back to MSU mid-60s or something.
Yeah, and we pretty completed our PhDs here. And I taught as a grad assistant while I was working on there.
Taught for who?
I taught for the Department of American Thought and Language one semester.
Was it already called American Thought and Language then?
No, it was Comms Skills then.
Comms Skills?
No, it was American Thought and Language then. Well,
I can look it up.
It was ATL because I don't know what the curriculum.
And you did
was.
That as a grad student?
Did one semester, and then I continued to teach in that preparatory English program. And then I taught a course or two in the College of Education during the summer. Taught a graduate course there in sex and gender differences, we'd say today. Yeah.
What was it called then?
Well, it was sex differences, I think. That is a more elegant title, but it was really a course in kind of developmental psychology. So I had a lot of different teaching experiences, I guess. And then I settled in at old ATL and stayed right there.
So what?
From 77, 87, not for 30 years, 32 years I stayed there.
32 years with ATL?
Right.
Who was the last chair?
The last chair.
Or who was the first?
Well, the first chair when I came there was Bern Engel. He was chair. I should know the name of the person who preceded him. Paul Bagwell, maybe. I don't know, but certainly it was Bern Engel when I came. And he remained quite a while there. And then Jocelyn Slade took over. And with Jocelyn T. and then. And then Doug Dover. I don't know who's. Oh, Kitty Geisler's chair there.
No,
yeah.
But it would have been. So what year did you retire from there?
I officially retired in 1999, but I taught one other year, on a one course in the fall term. Could have continued to do that, but I didn't.
So one of my questions to you was, there are two ways we could go. One is what were the when did faculty start talking about unions, or to what extent were there certain governance kinds of issues that were bothering the faculty, and then sort of how did you get involved?
Well, I suppose faculty were talking a little bit about unions even while I was working on my doctorate, because the dissertation that I did was a comparison of the English teacher role, comparing student teachers and teachers in the field, and also male and female. And one of the questions we put on that, or some of the questions I had on that questionnaire, had to relate, or did relate toward attitudes toward unionization among teachers. And it's kind of interesting there that there was a clear gender split. Men favored that. A great percentage over women.
Do you have anybody in LIR in your committee or econ or?
No, didn't.
Okay.
We just sort of did that.
Just curious.
I think that was a burgeoning no on my committee. Well, Betty Rusk, who's now over at Bertram Hills, was my chair. Louise Sauce, who's still a good friend, was on that committee. George Myers was on that committee. I had some other, a couple other people. Must have had one from the English department, but I can't even remember their names. I'd have to look it up.
So because of the topic of your dissertation, you were already somewhat familiar.
Yes.
How did you ever choose that? You already were interested in unions because of...
Well, there were a whole lot of... I was interested...
There's a whole lot of questions.
I was interested, really, in what
gender.
I had expected to do, really, was to go out, work in a public school system, perhaps, or do something in terms of teacher training.
Okay.
Yeah. And so we were interested in how closely the perceptions of our students or students who were training there matched up with the actual experience of teachers in the field.
Okay.
See, so that's how I got into that.
Oh, okay.
And I would have still liked to have gone on. I like public education. I think I had good experiences there and probably would have persevered, but and I had, there were job offers. There were still job offers when Jerry and I got our degrees. But my father became ill, died. I was the only child, and my mother simply couldn't function on her own. So we were kind of constrained to stay in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And the job opened up in ATL, and so I went there, although I couldn't use in ATL much of the training that I had, professional training that I had in the College of Education.
Uh-huh.
A lot of the training I had there, frankly, was in the behavioral sciences.
Uh-huh.
And it didn't mesh very well mm-hmm. with teaching about the Puritans. So I had to polish up my Puritans, you might say.
Is that what you taught for ATL?
Well, our course, when I went into that, it was an excellent course. It really was. I thought so at the time, but as I look back over it, I appreciate its strengths. It was a survey of American literature and history,
okay.
writing-based survey, and there was really some substantive readings there
mm-hmm.
and topics that I don't know, I don't think we still have today so much of. I could talk to you about the changes in the undergraduate curriculum, but I guess we're not on that today.
So even in your dissertation, that you knew there was a little interest beyond your dissertation.
We're talking about unions.
As a new faculty member, why were some faculty talking about unions, and which faculty were?
Well, I think people were sensitive to the fact that faculty didn't have the input that they would like to have into the educational process.
Okay.
And then, of course, as we came into the 60s, you know, there was the civil rights movement, there was the student protest, there was a general radical agitation.
Uh-huh.
That was before your time. Right? You were involved to an extent in the union movement, sure you were.
I was involved as a student activist
yeah.
in high school and college.
Yeah, and you worked with faculty associates for a while, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's
after I came.
After you came, yeah, with yeah. Bob Rivas, yeah.
But anyway, so you're saying that some faculty felt a lack of input in governance.
Lack of input.
And then the general civil rights and student...
sort of supported a protest movement.
Right.
Yeah, you know.
That kind of put a time frame to this.
Yeah.
And
of course, there was growing dissatisfaction among some faculty groups, especially about salaries, because there was a marked difference in salary.
What do you mean by marked difference?
I mean some departments were paying their people a whole lot more than others. And it was, I could tell you about the sex discrimination suit that faculty...
Could you?
Yeah, okay.
Go ahead.
Well,
first get me into faculty associates.
Okay.
How does it appear?
Well, faculty associates was a small group.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an MEA affiliate.
Mm-hmm.
I believe MEA had a real hope that MEA could organize MSU. If it could, certainly it would have been a real feather in their cap. MEA was a great help to faculty associates, so I explained that a little bit. But anyhow, that's how we organized. I don't know exactly who made the MEA contact. I can't remember that now. And then, of course, the other group was the AAUP.
Mm-hmm.
And the AAUP was, of course, the more accepted academic group. You know, you could be an AAUP member, and that was very respectable. But if you were a faculty associates member, not maybe quite so much so.
Okay.
And our membership drew heavily from American thought and language. Its leadership, much of its
uh-huh.
leadership was there. Mary Tompkins, I was there. Phil Kors, Bruce mm-hmm. Curtis, The administration wasn't wrong in thinking that we were a hotbed of unionization sentiments there, because that was the case. But there was a lot of strong support also over in the art department. Pollock, I remember, was one of our members, John Pollock, and some others too. I believe Jim Adley was. And we had representatives from the School of Nursing, as I recall. But you could see a marked division there among those who were working particularly with faculty associates, and maybe those who were with AAUP. But out of all of this, we did conclude that there was a good amount of gender discrimination existing on our campus. And I think Mary Tompkins and I, we were chair of the Women's Rights Committee of the Faculty Associates at that time, and did some preliminary work. And MEA, I should have reviewed all that went before.
We can talk another time.
MEA agreed to support a suit against MSU on the basis of salary discrimination.
Do you know about when that is?
That must have been the early 70s.
Early?
Early or mid 70s.
Okay.
Yeah, right about in there. So that suit was filed, and they retained two attorneys. And we, after a period of research and so forth, our part of the administration eventually went into federal court. This was a case brought in federal court. And I remember it was in the summer, and Dorothy McMeekin and I, and some others, but mostly Dorothy McMeekin and I, went together, you know, to sit on our side of the courtroom. And we had the administration over there, Lee Winder, and all the power figures on their side. Dorothy was a knitter, and she took her knitting, and she sat there quite unperturbed through all of these, all the goings on, knitting, you know, kind of like Madame Defarge in Tale of Two Cities. Well, the upshot of that case was that after all that summer of hearings, MSU agreed to settle. We didn't walk it through to the end, which I guess was a good thing. And the settlement came, what came out of the settlement was cohort analysis, and I think that still exists on that campus, doesn't it? Yeah. A comparison, well, you know about that, John, between a person in one department, we'll say ATL, who had had 20 years experience, and a person in another department who had 20 years experience, who was a man, and comparing salary differences, and they found really some marked differences. And some of the, I was not a named plaintiff on that, so I believe that Dorothy McMeekin was. Two women in the art department, Margaret Ewell, I've forgotten the other woman's name, but though the discrimination there in salary was awful, they got substantial settlements, and there were two or three others that did too. And I think at least that shaped up the university a little bit in terms of raising the salaries, particularly of women, bringing them up to a level.
That
is one of the achievements I would say the union movement had, that faculty associates had on that campus. The first election, the faculty associates did take a terrible beating. AAP, not so much so. But again, I credit MEA here. What they did was give us a sum of money, not very much. Some $1,200 kind of sticks in my mind. It may have been more, but not a whole lot more. And Mary Tompkins and I were quite involved then. What we did, we bought...
This is after the first election.
After the first election, where, you know, I suppose it might just have gone away, but it didn't. What we did was buy space in the state news. And of course, as a paid advertiser, sort of, then we could really say what we wanted because we bought the space. And we had a number of people around campus who would write for us and research the issues. And we got some good columns out there that I think gave the administration some cause for unease. Yeah, kept the cause alive, so to speak. We didn't crawl back into the woodwork. Mary Tompkins was a real fighter. You knew Mary.
Yeah, a little.
Yeah, a little. Yeah, she was. Absolutely was.
When you say first election.
I think there were three elections.
Mm-hmm.
Weren't there were three.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the middle one, you may remember more than I do. For some reason or another, I don't remember that one too clearly. I know we didn't prevail in any of them.
The first one's before my time.
Yeah.
I come in 77.
Yeah.
And the first one's way back in 70 or 71.
Yeah, that's right. That was the very first one when we were all real novices.
Mm-hmm. I didn't bring the dates with me, but the second's about 78.
Okay.
Maybe 78, yeah. 79, and the next one is 80, 81.
Yeah.
There wasn't much distance between the second and the third. And my recollection is that the third probably wouldn't have happened except that the fiscal crisis had just occurred.
You're right. And all of that reorganization of the university, I think you're right.
And so Cecil Mackey came in.
Yeah, yeah, with an axe.
And the perception was that he came in with an axe and was an outside hired gun. And I think that sparked another election fairly soon after. But I think there wasn't much difference in the votes in the second and third election. But
no.
I don't have it in front
strange,
of me.
No, that's true. Strangely enough, AAUP picked up some support.
Mm-hmm.
I think it really was the death knell of faculty associates.
Yeah.
At that point, MEA was not good to organize that faculty. One mistake I think MEA made was stressing too much and using too much the term teacher. This will help teachers.
Uh-huh.
University professors do not want to think of themselves as teachers by and large.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, I think you're right about the flip-flop. I guess I think the total number was about 60-40 against both times. But who was second and who's third switches between those two elections.
Yeah. And had, after that election, faculty associates was out of the picture, really.
After the third.
Yeah. After the I've always felt, I don't have any evidence for it, but I've always felt that if AAUP had moved ahead aggressively right then,
uh-huh.
that they might have organized that campus.
Uh-huh.
But there are people who feel that AAUP didn't want to do that, and the union movement really did. The movement for organization died out. Is there any talk of organization on that campus now?
Yes, not among tenured faculty.
Oh, I bet among the temporaries that are the most abused group of people ever.
Depending on how you count it, there's three organizing efforts going on.
Are there?
The main one's been going on for a year is with Michigan Federation of Teachers.
Yes.
They obtained a consent agreement with U of M to represent the lecturers.
Okay.
I'm sure they collected cards, but I don't believe there was an election. And they now represent a little less than 1,000 fixed-term temporary lecturers at U of M. And then they went and picked up a similar group at Wayne State who were out, the faculty at Wayne State are unionized. However, they had a growing area of fixed-term instructors, and AMFT picked them up recently and just signed their first contract. And they now have an organizing drive going at MSU for a similar kind of group. That is fixed-term teaching people with sort of faculty titles but aren't tenure track. And they've been around campus almost a year now. They've had some meetings with the administration. As faculty grievance official, nobody comes to see me or tells me anything about this. But I sort of know some things, as I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, that then has sparked, MEA, as you may know, has a small group of supervisors out at MSU. And it appears that...
That's the AP group?
Mm-hmm.
They organize the APs, okay.
The APs went to MEA.
Yeah.
They'd been around for a little while.
Yeah.
Anyways, there's some discussion that group has approached the university about picking up maybe some piece of academic specialist who are supervisors. Meanwhile, there's some third effort. So two of the efforts, I guess, are sort of looking to add on to existing units to accrete, to get the university to agree or to have elections to get accretions to current ones. The main issue is this MFT attempt to organized this, about 1,000 fixed-term faculty. As you may know better than I, the tenure-track faculty at MSU has stayed about the same during my years, at about 2,000.
Yeah, okay.
It's fluctuated a little, but what's really changed is there used to just be several hundred of fixed-term faculty, and now, depending on how you count them, there's a couple thousand. It's hard to say exactly what you mean by faculty, but sometimes the university uses a number for tenure track that's about 2,000, and for all other academic people who come under academic human resources, about 2,800. And like I say, about 1,000 of them are teaching, are primarily teachers. Others are academic specialists and counselors and extension agents and all that sort of thing. So there are some organizing drives, but not, I've heard nothing in terms of what was the efforts back then, which was, and maybe you could correct me, I didn't go into the research yet on looking at the bargaining units, but my recollection was AUP and FA were both interested in tenure-track faculty.
Yes, that's right.
I don't recall that it was a discussion, and I think it's partly because in the 70s,
there weren't
that many.
There were not.
It was a small number.
That's right. Well, we did talk about it, and as I recall, I think that faculty associates favored including these people in the bargaining unit, because I remember we were all rather distressed at what LCC did. You know, they didn't include their people, their part-time or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And they had the same situation, maybe still do have it down there, of a marked difference in salary between tenured faculty and the many hordes of adjuncts and whatever that they can easily employ because of their proximity to the university. So we talked about it. I think that was a stand we were going to take, that we were going to put those people in. But as you say, there weren't so many of them.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's a huge number.
Right. So it's changed.
And they are exploited. I think that is one of the great shames of the academic profession, that we have let that kind of exploitation occur without more protests. There, that's my soapbox.
Well, it's become a national issue.
A national disgrace.
Yeah. MSU probably uses less. The balance at MSU, while it's changed drastically, is probably still more tenure track of a total percent than many other universities.
Is it really?
And especially when you get to places like a community college, they almost are entirely part-timers.
I know they are.
They're very few.
You are paid next to nothing.
Going back to the lawsuit and those times, if I could ask you a little more. For a few years, you were actually the president of the FA.
Yes, I have forgotten what years they were, because I was the president. Should have researched that.
And a few years, as I say, I came in 77, and during that next couple years, in that second election, either you or Phil Korth, I think, were the president.
Yes, that's right, yeah. And, of course, I think I was president probably during that reorganization, because I know we fought that tooth and nail, particularly as some of the hits about on University College and the School of Nursing.
Yeah. Those were the two things that really strike at your mind.
Yeah, that sticks in my mind. Yeah, well,
the nursing
University College was dissolved.
Mm-hmm.
In the departments, with the exception of ATL attached somewhere else.
Were you involved at all in discussions or complaints about the change of Lyman Briggs back to a school and the elimination of Justin Morrow?
Involved in what way?
Just, was that an issue that faculty associates talked about?
Oh,
or?
Yes, of course, yeah.
Okay.
Of course, yeah. Particularly, yes, both of them, because that's the feeling always was that all of that happened without much faculty input.
Uh-huh.
It just occurred. Now they're recreating Justin Morrow. In fact, you're attached to the recreation of it, aren't you?
Sort of, yeah.
This day, the wheel comes around.
What's your recollection of why Justin Morrow was eliminated?
Well, I suppose, it was clearly a teaching college.
Uh-huh.
Innovative college, right?
Mm-hmm.
and maybe just didn't fit into the model of rigorous academic scholarship that seemed to be the going thing at that time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And that was what the chief gripe was about University College, that it wasn't rigorously, well, it wasn't, it didn't perform along the traditional lines that the provost wanted. Lee Winder, who was very much a traditionalist in that regard.
And the complaint was that University College was too focused on teaching and not on scholarship promotion? Okay. Lee Winder was the provost then, and you mentioned that he was at those summer hearings.
Oh, yes, he was.
Anybody else you recall being part
of? Jack Kinzinger.
Who?
Jack Kinzinger, who was the associate provost.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you a funny thing. Maybe I shouldn't tell you this funny thing.
I'm sure
of course, there was always a noon recess, you know, when everyone went for lunch. And I came back earlier one day. And all of these administrators, Lee Winder had them in a room, and they were doing calisthenics. He was
really?
Leading them.
Really?
Psyching them up.
Very funny. Now, my recollection, and again, I should have done some homework, too. My recollection is that those hearings occurred actually after I came.
They may have.
That they were the summer of, like, 77
I
or 78.
It may very well have been, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But that, I would regard that as one of the real achievements of
mm-hmm.
faculty associates. Of course, people said that we did that, you know. We just to win an election. That was not the reason.
Mm.
And if they thought that through a little more clearly, they would have seen that to bring a suit on sex discrimination on an elected body that was primarily male wouldn't make good sense.
Uh-huh.
No. But we did it because we had a real sense and knowledge that there was an inequity here,
mm-hmm.
and there was. Yeah, and we really did help correct that.
And that led not just to some money for a few named people,
no,
but it led
whole
to the cohort
change.
Analysis.
That's right. That's what
and
I mean. Yes, the whole policy
and
change.
And a re-emphasis.
Yeah, and a re-emphasis,
uh-huh.
and a look at least
mm-hmm.
At how you're treating men and women differently.
Do you recall who were the main people? Again, I can look all this up, but who were the main people who were AUP leaders in either of those elections?
Well, Colette Mosier was always
uh-huh.
much involved.
Mm-hmm.
Roy Matthews. Roy Matthews is no longer in East Lansing. Is
mm-hmm.
he still living? I remember.
I don't know.
I don't know either. Gosh, you're going to have to look him up. I could look him up too, but I do remember Roy Matthews. AAUP's leadership was...
I should talk to Colette.
Yeah, you should talk to Colette
mm-hmm.
because you'd get a different perspective
mm-hmm.
there.
Mm-hmm.
Probably.
Is she
retired yet?
Not the last that I saw her, but it was in the spring. But she was still in Ag Econ. And her health's not great, but she was still...
What's the matter, I wonder?
I don't remember. She was limping, and
there were.
She's represented some people in the grievance procedure as counsel, and so she's come sometimes to represent people, either meetings to plan or at hearings.
Yeah.
And so I've seen her in those settings.
Yeah.
But she was, you know, her mind was great, and she was fine. I just hadn't thought. I mean, we just rediscussed this. I also talked to a gentleman recently about the grievance procedure history, Les Hyman.
Oh, yes.
And
yes. He was chair of the faculty associates, the faculty of...
University Committee on
yes,
Faculty.
Yes, yes. He was chair of that for many years.
Yeah.
Yeah. He finally got fed up. He totally did. And
so I did chat with... I did have
yeah.
an interview with him, and that
yeah.
was kind of fascinating.
Yeah. What did he have to say?
Oh, it's been a little while. He obviously was a leader of governance.
Yes, he was.
But he also was involved in the creation of the grievance procedure because
mm-hmm.
people had some complaints and concerns. And I'll have to look at my notes what the particulars
well,
were.
Well, I served on that committee for a good many years.
Uh-huh.
But I always felt his primary function was to rubber stamp the administration.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I interviewed Lash years ago, and I'll have to...
Yeah.
He was certainly an AUP-er.
Yes, he was, yeah.
But he also, at the time of the elections, was the grievance official.
Yeah.
And so I think he kept quiet,
Yeah.
which was unusual for him. But I'm thinking he was more quiet. And of course, since I worked with, and one of my main colleagues was mentor was Bob Ripas, there wasn't much question about which side of this I was going to be on. So I got to know the faculty associates people much more.
More than you could. Yeah,
yeah, the AUP people.
Yeah.
And really got to know them later.
Yeah. Les Hyman was a good person, though, you know.
Hmm?
Les Hyman was a good person.
Yeah, very interesting. It was a lot of fun. And I've been interviewing Bob Banks for an administration perspective.
Yeah, and
on
I think
these
Bob
questions.
Banks is a fine person too.
Yeah.
Really.
I probably should. Is Winder around?
He, I believe, still is.
I should probably.
They say he has an office in the administration building somewhere.
Yeah.
I do believe he's still mentoring Luana. Well, you know, that's what he did.
A little.
Oh, more than a little, John, more than a little.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and you can see his policies that she's following up on.
Thinking
if
back,
you could interview him.
Yeah, that would be an interesting idea.
It would be. Do you know Jeff Charley?
Not really. I mean, I know who he is, but why?
Well, he interviewed him. For the part of the series of interviews that they did for the sesquicentennial, and he told Jeff that the single most, as he recalled it, I've been told this correctly, that the single most significant event of his administration that he valued most was the destruction of University College.
Really?
That is how it was reported to me.
Okay. Well, I will look for that interview tape.
Yeah, look for it and see. Yeah.
Okay. There's some other ones that I'm, one was done with Keith Grody.
Yeah.
Who he was vice president of human resources. He wasn't involved with faculty concerns.
Now, Mary Grody, she did something too, right? His wife didn't? Maybe
I don't know.
Maybe not. Okay.
I don't know that.
Okay.
I don't
Keith
know that.
Grody was vice
but he
president.
Also was part of this group in the interview tapes, and there's several of those I need to check. But back in a couple other things, my recollection of the third election, and I remember the third more than the second because I actually chaired the organizing committee in the third election. Besides art, nursing, ATL, it seemed to me there were a handful, well, it seemed to me that most of the strength of the FA was in arts and letters.
Yes, it was.
And then a fair amount of social science.
Yeah.
Certainly sociology and...
where the salaries were lowest.
Yeah.
Yeah, essentially.
And there were even some in Nat Science who had been sort of in the basic college.
Sure, it followed there. Well,
right.
Dorothy McMeekin was one of them. Yeah.
And a number of people like in math.
There were some. You wouldn't expect that in math, but there were.
Yeah. But it seemed like my recollection was that we just had, while there were a few exceptions here and there, like an engineer here or a doc there, whatever, for the most part, we really couldn't break into those areas, into the sciences beyond the basic Nat Sci.
One of our members went over to the med school and was actually thrown out. You're not trying to circulate guys.
And one of the issues, and I don't know if you were much involved in this or not, was the issue about bargaining unit determination. And I don't know if you were part of those discussions or not.
Who was included in the unit, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, that was where the issue of the temporaries would come in.
And it also is the issue of whether or not the med school people should be included.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And do you recall that at all,
not
those discussions?
Not a whole lot. Although, how did it get resolved?
The university's position was that they're all MSU faculty, so they should be included. My recollection was FA and MEA attorneys argued they shouldn't because a substantial part of their income was coming from separate sources, and that only those people who their entire almost all their income was as a university employee, and that we had these bargaining unit determination meetings down at Merck's offices in Lansing,
yeah.
and that the union didn't succeed in that. And I have no idea, I'll have to look into some records, whether or not AUP took a position about this or not. But my recollection would be similar to yours, though I would state it even more negatively, and that is, my sense was that many of the AUP people had really no interest in unionization.
Absolutely not. They were a company union in some ways.
But felt if the union's going to be here, then it ought to be us.
That's right. That's right. But they really didn't want a union. As I say,
I didn't. My sense as a young junior Fankley member was that most of them didn't really.
No. Because they could have had one after that third election. They picked up strength, and the situations in higher ed at Michigan State were such that if they really moved on that, and they had people who were better placed in the academic power structure than we did here, who carried more academic credibility. I don't mean in terms of but you know what I mean. They were
the people in governance. They were on those committees.
They chaired those committees. That's right, and they went to the cocktail parties and so forth, and they could have done it if they wanted to. But they clearly did not. So that never happened. I think had it happened, they could have at least have spared one thing that is a very negative thing, and that is post-tenure review. I don't know how that's going now, but even administrators didn't like post-tenure review. It was an ongoing process. You know, it never quit.
It was a very interesting thing that I don't know all the details. But when Luana was provost, and at Minnesota they had put in a post-tenure review, and it sparked a unionization effort at Minnesota, which failed, but in a very close vote. And I think after that, the discussion at MSU basically ended in terms of seriously trying to implement a post-tenure review. It's on the books. But sort of in a meaningless way. I mean, it doesn't.
Now, whatever.
Yeah, now, yeah.
Because when I left there, they were still going through it. Everybody filled out their forms. And
yeah, but there really is no serious post-tenure review process.
Well, good. But one thing, it was an administrative nightmare. You know?
Yeah.
It was bad enough to do this for non-tenured people, but now you've got all these tenured people, and the paperwork piled up like that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think they simply decided to pursue, if there were egregious problems, pursue termination or encouraging early retirement or something of that sort, in doing it on a more individual basis. But there, if you look at the Fankley Handbook online, you'll find one little section that has like a paragraph or so about post-tenure review, but I've never heard of it being implemented by any department in any way. So, but. Anyways, I could be wrong, but my sense of it was that this Minnesota story kind of
put the kibosh on that.
So while we're chanting, I don't know if there's other things to say about unionization effort at MSU.
I can't think of anything that immediately comes to mind.
You were already, or during this time, you became active in the Michigan Women's Associate.
Well, we organized it on the campus.
When did that happen?
Why, it happened in 1972, and I've got my dates down there.
72?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. And at MSU? I didn't realize. Okay.
Actually, five faculty members in the ATL department.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We had a very active department, John.
Who were the five?
Joyce Ladenson, Jonathan Slade, no longer in the state. A man, Al Carson, who's deceased.
Okay.
Myself and Sandy Gustafson, who left the state,
And the main purposes and reasons for creating
Because we were working to develop a women's studies curriculum, see.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very threatened. Women's studies courses were, this was the time of all the cutbacks.
Mm-hmm.
And so here comes new programs, new programs that it's hard to create new programs when you're cutting programs left and right.
Mm-hmm.
So we organized in that way as a professional organization to give each other some support, to bring in other programs around the state, and to be a kind of vehicle for exchanging information and providing younger scholars, particularly with a platform for sharing their research.
Was there a model in some other states? Was that
Actually, there was not. We
no?
were the first state organization of this kind. We even predated the development of the National Women's Studies Association.
Didn't know that.
Yeah.
Now, the idea of this museum and Hall of Fame didn't come right at that point.
No,
did it?
No.
Okay.
That was 72 that we organized. It wasn't until 79 that we conceived that idea, because we really wanted to do a kind of community-based education. We had relied on a conference and a newsletter, but philosophically, women's studies believe, or used to, I don't know what believes now for sure, believed in an interchange between the academic world, the academy, and the broader community.
Okay.
But I think some of that is gone now because it's had to become, or it has had to conform to institutional norms in order to survive. But I don't know whether we really saw that change coming or not, but at any rate, we wanted to be closer to the community.
And so the idea of the Hall of Fame and the museum
the
then was that outreach?
Was that outreach, yeah.
Okay.
When we began, we had thought we would do more just feminist education and left less Hall of Fame, but the tail wags the dog in some cases.
Now, I get in your own brochures, but just I'm curious. Were you always here? Was there another site first?
No.
Okay.
We raised the money to renovate this house, which is owned by the city of Lansing, and we have it on a $1 a year lease.
Okay. And so it stayed the same.
Yeah.
Now, when you were doing the work in terms of the Women's Studies Association, did you start teaching some classes in that area, or were you
still? Yes, we were all five of us. See, what happened in ATL, when I came, we had one course, the ATL course.
Uh-huh.
Then, that sun's in your eyes. You want to
move? That's okay.
Close
it's
in.
Fine.
No, you don't mess it like that.
Great, thank you.
Does that help? No, no. So,
there you go. You got it now.
Okay.
So you started teaching, or there was just one course?
Yes, there was. Then you know about the movement for curriculum reform and the protests on the part of students that education wasn't relevant. You were part of that generation.
Not here at MSU.
No,
I was.
But you were part of that generation.
Yeah, right.
That education is not
right.
Relevant. We've got to make it relevant. So the one main track, ATL, the big course that we were teaching, we evolved some what we called tracks. There was a film track. I taught in that for a while. And then there was a developing interest in women's studies. There were some courses being taught around the country. So we evolved the Women in America course. Joyce Cadence and all the four of us there who were part of this organization. And there, we were one of the first courses on that campus. Barry Thorne. Barry Thorne was involved in the gay movement, too. I think she was AAUP, though. But she was teaching over in sociology. And our course then was one of the first on that campus.
So when did you start the women's studies course, do you think?
The women's studies course is probably right around 1970, because we formed the organization shortly after we began teaching.
So did you start teaching that then, in that area?
Yes, I did.
Did
I
you
taught that exclusively.
Yes. Oh, okay.
Once in a while I would teach the regular ATL course, but for the most part I taught that exclusively.
Okay. And until you retired, I was.
Actually, I retired, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Kind of fascinating. Do you keep track of that at all, or is that kind of?
Oh, yes, I keep in touch with Joyce Ladenson. And they had a major in women's studies that she worked very hard on, and they eliminated that, and now they put it back. Luana put it back, because I'm told because other Big Ten schools had majors in women's studies, and MSU couldn't be a school who did something different from the other ones.
Did you get the phone?
We got other person upstairs.
Okay. Does the university have any connection with your Hall of Fame and program anymore, or not at all?
No.
Okay.
From the beginning, it didn't. We are independent 501c3. Yeah.
Pretty interesting.
Yeah.
There's some other things I should ask you about MSU governance issues and faculty, or about anything connected.
Are you asking me a question?
I'm sorry. Are there some other? Yeah, I was asking. Is there anything else I should ask you? People?
I don't think of anything. Really.
Okay. If I get some dates or other details about some of the MEA AUP unionization.
Yeah.
I'll get back to you
okay.
and figure out another time.
Okay.
I just didn't.
And what I could do too, as I told you, I've got a lot of material at home that's archival materials I've got to put in the archives. I can dig that out and look back through it.
I'd love to look at it on its way to the.
Okay, all right, good.
For the archives.
As soon as we get past this Hall of Fame dinner and so forth, I can take a little time doing that because I don't want that in my house.
Yeah, Fred is retired.
I know he has. Portia Vecchio, do you know her?
Portia still works there.
She works over there.
And she's been helpful for me. I'm trying to do this. I need to do a little institutional history of the grievance office because it's 35 years old.
Is this a book you're working on?
Well, it's several little projects. Some articles sort of thing. It's not a book per se.
I see.
Anyways, Portia's been helpful on some stuff I've been trying to find out to do this institutional history in the grievance office, which is 35 years old. And so she is there and helpful. And I know they're interested in adding to this part of their collection on issues in terms of unionization and faculty and the grievance office stuff. So, but the ombuds office did an internal history a couple of years ago. So we should do one. And then I have done some bits and pieces about MSU, such as pretty much finished with the history of the school labor industrial relations.
Oh, have you?
Yeah. I did a number of interviews about that, and I need to sort of ramp that up. But because it was actually in context of that that I interviewed Lash and Walter.
Oh, yeah.
Some people didn't
Good
know.
Thing
but
that
the,
you did that.
But the beginning of the school labor industrial relations, everybody was joint appointments. And so a lot of people didn't realize that Walter Adams and Lash LaRue and several other people that folks don't associate with LIR had LIR appointments in the late 50s.
Yeah.
And so it was as part of that, but then we talked about other things too. So, anyways, Mike Rubner was just in town to do something for Mike Rubner.
Oh, yes,
the previous grievance official.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So I interviewed him a couple of weeks ago about it.
Mm. And you're the grievance official now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like that?
It's interesting.
Yeah, I know.